Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second No Tune Unturned interview. If you listened to the last one, you might remember that we had Jimmy Henson, or otherwise known as Big Giant Circles, on. And this time, we have a second uber special guest. Of course, I'm Stephen Kelly, your usual host, but that's not really the exciting part, because we have Grant Kirkhope here. Hello, Grant.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, and thank you very much for showing up. I'm happy to have you here.
It's no problem. I'm a media whore. I'll talk to anybody.
Well, I'm glad I'm on that list. So to start this off, Grant, why don't you let the folks at home, for those of you who don't know, who are you exactly?
I am Grant Kirkhope. I'm a video games I'm a composer of all sorts of things. I was at Rare from 1995 to 2008. So I did kind of Banjo-Kazooie games and Donkey Kong 64 and Perfect Dark and Grab by the Ghoulies and GoldenEye and, Viva Pinata.
Oh, right, right.
Things like that. All that stuff.
I was really scared you were going to leave off Viva Pinata.
No. And then I moved to Big Huge Games in 2008 and did Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning. That's what I've been.
Right. Excellent. I mean, that's quite a repertoire right there.
Thank you very much.
So, I think a good first question to start off with, Grant, would be, why music? Why are you in the music industry in the first place? Has it always been a hobby or a passion of yours, or was it something that you developed later on?
Well, I'm in the games industry by complete luck and fluke. When I was a kid, I played recorder at four at school, and I got a cornet at six, and then started playing trumpet a bit later, and then I was a self-taught sort of metal guitar player at 11, but I went through the usual music route at school because honestly it's all I'm any good at. I'm really bad at everything else, and I'm not just kind of saying that to be jokey. I'm terrible at everything, really. My brain only works one way, I think, and that's it. So my wife will certainly tell you I'm terrible at everything that involves not music.
I get that.
Yeah, so I went to music college in the UK, the Royal Northern College of Music, did 4 years degree, trumpet was my major, and then I played in metal bands and all, and I left college at 22 and spent 11 years playing in rock bands and, you know, on guitar and bands on trumpet and stuff. And just, you know, some bands did well and sometimes on unemployment. It was just to and fro like that for 11 years.
So, I mean, you had plenty of practice with a, you know, pretty diverse range of musical abilities. And how the heck did that land you with Rare?
Yeah, it was just a fluke. I have a very good friend of mine, Robin Beanland, who was already at Rare. We used to play in bands together in North Yorkshire, where we lived. And he one day up and announced he had got a job at Rare, and off he went. I was like, oh. About a year and a half went by, and the bands that I was playing for were sort of all falling to pieces. Mm-hmm. I just thought I'd end up a tramp, really. I had no kind of skill at all to do anything. And he said to me, look, you know, why don't you try and do what I'm doing? And he'd been at Rare, as I say, a year and a half. And so he recommended me to buy a copy of Cubase and an Atari ST computer and bits and pieces. And I spent a year sort of, I played a lot of video games. It was a SNES at the time.
Sure.
I sort of sent off five cassette tapes to Rare over the course of a year and never got a reply to any of the things I sent off. And then out of the blue, I just got this letter saying, please come for an interview. And I was like, oh, wow. So I went there on the Friday for the interview, I remember. And then on the Monday, I got a letter saying he got the job. And it's like, oh, my God, I've got a job. I couldn't believe it. So and that was how it started, really. It was a complete coincidence, just for luck.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic. And I think that that's oftentimes what you're going to hear in, you know, this industry, especially when video games were kind of new and in some ways not respected, because it wasn't on a lot of people's radar, right?
No, it wasn't on my radar. I didn't think about it at all.
Because nowadays you have huge scores like, well, Kingdoms of Amalur, for example, or Darksiders 2, World of Warcraft, that sort of thing. People can look at the, the composition scene for video games and say, I'm going to shoot for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was much, much smaller back then.
Oh, definitely. It was nothing like it is now.
Yeah, so it's a very different process of getting your foot in the door, I guess.
Mm, definitely.
So what was your first project at Rare?
I had to convert Dave Wisey's tunes from Donkey Kong 2 on the snares to the Game Boy.
Ah, that is a brilliant soundtrack as well.
It is a great soundtrack. Dave did a fantastic job on those games. It just was like my first day. He sort of came in. He showed me how to do it very quickly, and I thought, oh my God, this is really complicated. I'm never going to be able to manage this. And it was all in hex, and I didn't have, you know, I'd been used to MIDI files and stuff. So looking at, you know, a black and white screen with four numbers on it, I was thinking, how's this going to relate to music? I didn't understand it at all. And it was very, I only thought I might have to resign because I was too stupid to understand it. So I told Robin, I said, Robin, I just can't do this. It's too hard for me. So look, get Dave back in again and ask him to show you again a bit more slowly. So I got Dave back in the next day and I wrote every kind of move down. He showed me on the computer and I gradually got round it. But I quite enjoyed that in the end. I think at first it was quite daunting, but it was quite fun to see what you could squeeze out of the Game Boy in the end. So it was quite a good laugh at the end.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the reasons I like listening to some older soundtracks from those days, because the instruments you had at your disposal were, like you said, so limited that it almost became a creative and entertaining challenge of its own to see if you could coax something that sounded like an orchestra or sounded like a rock band out of it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was great fun to do.
So, after Donkey Kong...
Yeah, so Graham Norgate, who was already there, he was doing Blast Corps and GoldenEye at the same time, and said, "Look, Blast Corps getting really busy. Why don't you help me out by doing GoldenEye?" So he wanted to do Blast Corps, and I said, "Oh, great!" So I was doing the Game Boy in the morning. So I started at Rare in October '95, and then I was doing the GoldenEye in the afternoon. And I did the Game Boy by Christmas, so then I was completely on GoldenEye after Christmas.
Okay, gotcha.
So I started doing that while he was concentrating on Blast Corps.
So when you started to move on to GoldenEye, how closely did you end up working with the source material, the soundtrack from the movie?
Well, I listened to the GoldenEye soundtrack quite a lot, actually, but it was by Eric Serra, and I didn't really like the way he did the GoldenEye, the kind of Bond score. He was trying to make it more electronic, because that was kind of the sound of the time. I know that's a good score, I just didn't really like it, but I did sort of take some elements from that. But I spent most of my time listening to all the old, you know, the classic pop songs at the start of all the movies, like the TLC and Duran Duran and all the rest of it, you know. And I mean, you know, it was great to listen to those tracks and then try and knock them together my own using the tune. And also Monty Norman, who's the guy that, you know, it wrote the original Bond theme tune, is very protective of that tune and doesn't let people use it really. But we're very lucky that we were allowed to use a tune. So I was, you know, for someone of my generation, Bond's is still a big deal to me. I love the Bond movies, all of them. I like to get to use that tune and to try and do it in different styles was just, you know, the best fun ever, you know, so I really enjoyed that. That was great.
Yeah, excellent. So what came next?
And that was when, and then I was pretty three quarters of the way through GoldenEye, and GoldenEye was getting quite behind. Mm-hmm. And I got a visitation from Tim Stamper, who was obviously the boss of Rare, along with his brother Chris Stamper, and another guy who didn't know who he was, and he kind of walked in and said, "Right, Grant, can we hear your tunes, please?" And I was like, "Oh, God, I must have done something wrong," you know, so I did them. And Tim sat on the floor, and this other lad sat in the chair. I thought, "Oh my God, this guy's so important that the boss is sitting on the floor." Completely, you know, thinking, "Oh my, what, you know, who could this guy be?" And so they just sat there, and I just played through the GoldenEye tunes, and they didn't say much. Said, "Yeah, next one, please. Next one, listen." I thought, "Oh God, this is terrible," you know. And then he said, "Right, that's good. I would like to come work in our game now." I said, "Oh, what's that?" "Oh, it's Dream." I said, "Well, Dave Wise is on that." "So yeah, want to come work with Dave?" I said, "Oh," I said, "Well, I'm not quite finished GoldenEye." So, no, you have finished GoldenEye. That's it now. You come to work an hour game. It's like, all right. So I didn't get to finish GoldenEye. I moved offices, went across to work on Dream with Dave. And then, of course, Dream turned into Banjo-Kazooie.
Right. And that's kind of an interesting story that I don't think a lot of people fully grasp or know about at all. So could you let us in on that transition between, you know, the prototype Dream to the lovable Banjo-Kazooie everyone is familiar with?
Well, Dream was originally going to be on the SNES. And then it kind of, because the N64 was just about, we had it in development there, you know, obviously, it got switched to that. And the plan was that they had that, they called the 64DD, was the drive that sits underneath the N64. They did sell some of them, but not very many. Mm-hmm. And the plan was to have Dream run on that, because it needed the extra memory and the extra systems and stuff.
Okay.
And so me and Dave were doing it together. And then we had this really elaborate kind of floor system where you could stretch the polygons to any shape, so you could make these really great landscapes, which were really, you know, far more intricate than you'd seen on any console to that, but you know, prior to that date. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, then the N64 just wasn't powerful enough to run it, and we had real problems getting up to speed and running it at a good frame rate.
Right.
And Dream was a very much like a Zelda-esque RPG with a boy character, and he had a dog called Dinger who ran about with him. And they had goblins and stuff, and Captain Black Eye was the main protagonist, and it was a really fun thing. We did have a demo running, actually, that we did, which was on a cartridge, which I thought was great. But then we just couldn't get it to run to the right speed.
Right.
So, and then at that point, Conker's 12 Tales was going, and they had a really great demo. They were doing it the old way of, like, just like Mario 64, with, like, you know, big textures on the floor, you know, big, yep, you know, polygons. So it was it ran much more efficiently. And we were all sort of trooped across to see the Conker demo, which was fantastic. And we were like, oh god, their game's so good, now it's so crap, you know. And then Tim said, look, you know, let's not do this anymore. Let's just do a platformer like Mario. You know, I'm started to think about redesigning it all. And so pretty quickly, Stephen Hurst, the environment artist, who was a, you know, bit of a whiz, you know, got a level up and running within a day, probably, using the kind of Conker system.
Right.
And we thought, oh, this is great, you know, but Tim was adamant, wanted to have animals in it. So I think Banjo was a rabbit at the start. We had a rabbit character for a little while. And then it changed to Banjo. And then because the fashion at the time in Japan was to have that, those where all the girls wore those kind of backs at, the backpacks.
Uh-huh.
We get the backpack, and then someone said, it puts them in their backpack. And then Gazoo was born like that, uh-huh, kind of that tandem thing.
Awesome.
And then the games started to come together pretty quick. And Conker, who were ahead of us, then sort of fell behind because they were trying lots of other different things. And so we kind of sort of took that, you know, we sort of overtook them and got going a bit more. And that's how the game started. And I was trying to write sort of super jolly tunes, a bit like Mario. But then as the characters of Banjo-Kazooie became more and more prevalent, you realize they were quite oddball and, you know, polar opposites. You know, it's like I started writing that kind of wacky music, that oddball music that kind of fitted the characters better. So that's how it came about, really. It just all came together really greatly.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting development story, especially how Conker and Banjo were, you know, basically being developed alongside one another.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, like you mentioned before, Dream started out as something a little more like an RPG. And if I remember correctly, I don't know if this is still the case, but you had some early music that you wrote for Dream up on your website.
Yeah, it's still there. I wrote 107 pieces of music for Dream, quite a lot.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I mean, a lot of that stuff was translated to Banjo-Kazooie.
Yeah, and I used some of Viva Pinata later, so I kept a lot of it. And I don't think I've used all of it, but I used quite a lot of it in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of wonderful to hear the roots and then how that's changed along with it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Which kind of leads into the next question, which is the name Banjo-Kazooie. Did you name the characters after the instruments once you had the music written? Or was that just something that you said, hey, those would be funny names, and therefore you wrote the score based after that?
Yeah, Tim wanted to have all the animals named after instruments. That was his idea.
Ah.
I remember that Tootie was called Piccolo at the start.
Hmm.
But he just, that's where it came from. He said it wouldn't be fun if the animals played their instruments. So Kazooie was a kazoo, etc., and band, you know, etc., all that kind of stuff. So that was Tim's idea to have that kind of, you know, the music thing. So he's on his mind because Tim was a massive games music fan and a real huge Nintendo music fan, and also the LucasArts games, like you know, especially Monkey Island, those kind of games. He loved those music. So he, you know, when I first got to Rare, him and Greg were very adamant that I played those games, and they wanted strong melody. So they kept talking about melody, 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 melody. That's all they ever said. You know, make sure it's a strong melody. You listen to it 50 times in a row and not get bored of it. You know, like, they really had that mantra, you know, right at the start of it all. That kind of got ingrained into me.
Yeah, and I think that it definitely paid off in the end. And you can see how much the music is ingrained into the game, actually. You know, because you're collecting music notes, for crying out loud. It's called Banjo-Kazooie. It's a very musical game. It's kind of alive.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was, again, another interesting piece of development history. And, you know, speaking of the sound from that game, where did you guys get all of those voices? How did you process, you know, their little goofy garbled talk?
Right.
How did you end up recording that?
Well, you know, in Dream, we did have actual full speech, and Tim wanted to have a full speech game, but there just wasn't the memory space for it. We couldn't get it pressed enough to get it in there. And we, at that time, we didn't have the access to MP3 like Conker did, so we just couldn't do it. So we came up with this idea about having this, you know, having like maybe a pool of like a 7, 8, 10 samples for each character that they would pull from. It would be a random pitch, you know, like kind of thing. So we'd select them randomly and random pitch all the time. And some of the characters had more samples than the others. Banjo had not very many. We couldn't get Banjo to sound good using lots of different samples, but I think other characters like Mumbo had quite a lot of syllables, you know. So it was just people on the team making funny noises, and that's what Chris Sutherland did. Banjo-Kazooie, I did Mumbo and the Jinjos and bits and pieces, and it was just like that. So it was just, you know, what needs must at the time. That was it.
Yeah. So are you responsible for the class and Ikum Bokum?
That's me.
All right.
Yes.
I'm sure you've had some autographs signed in that very manner.
Indeed. I mean, that was just a coincidence that because Mayhem Temple was originally in the first Banjo game.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and like the plan was to have a chant in the background, and so there's a funny British chant which is called "Come and have a go if you think you're hard enough." It was like a thing with skinheads would chant at football matches for fighting. And so I just did it in a funny voice, going "Come on, have a go if you think you're hard enough," like that, and then I slowed it down. "Come on, have a go if you think you're hard enough," and so that was there from the start. So when it came to having Mumbo's speech, I thought, well, those samples are already in the game. I just might as well use those samples. So I just kind of put them in a random. I just made them play randomly. But I found that when I played with them around, I could get them to say funny phrases. So Ikum Bokum was just those syllables rearranged into Ikum Bokum. It just came out that way.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's really interesting to know, because for you listeners out there, if you remember in Banjo-Tooie, there was a level where the background music was, well, essentially Mumbo chanting.
That's where it came from. That was written for the first game, but it didn't make it. It came to the second game.
Right. Okay. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Grant. After Banjo-Kazooie, would came Tooie.
Yeah.
And was that pretty much more of the same work? Did some stuff from Kazooie make it into Tooie at some point? And
yeah, but I think I had a larger palette then because we had more memory available.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Will Bryan, who was one of the programmers on Banjo-Tooie, he managed to join two MIDI files together, so I had 32 channels as opposed to 16, so I could do more channel fading.
Okay.
So that was a big thing. But I mean, but also that particular year was like a bit of a hard year for me, because Graham Norgate left and left behind Jet Force Gemini and Perfect Dark, and so Robin Beanland took on Perfect Dark, and Jet Force Gemini, I was given Perfect Dark to do, as well as Banjo-Tooie. And then I was also given Donkey Kong 64, so I did all those three games in the same year, really, which is quite a bit of a tall order to do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
yeah. So Tooie was sort of put on the back burner because Donkey Kong and Perfect Dark, I think, came out before it. I think, if I remember right, I might be wrong about that, but it certainly seemed that I worked on those games more than Tooie for the first, at least the first part of the year.
Okay. Yeah. And I think Banjo Kazooie and Tooie obviously had really similar sounds.
Yeah.
You can hear a lot of similarities in Donkey Kong 64 and even Grabbed by the Ghoulies as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's kind of safe to say that when Viva Pinata came along, it didn't sound the same anymore. That was a really different sound, and you had an orchestra to work with.
Yeah, yeah, because like Steve Berker was there at Rare. He'd done the live orchestra with Cameo, so that he was the first guy to do it at Rare, so we never really thought of that before. In fact, we nearly used it for Grabbed by the Ghoulies, but I was a bit late. So I got to do Viva Pinata with a live orchestra, which was incredible to do, really. So, I mean, you know, there's no greater thing for a composer to sit there and hear real people, you know, play his music. It's just amazing.
And, I mean, when I first played Viva Pinata, I was really surprised, because I was really familiar with Rare and all the stuff you guys had done in the past. And, you know, when I sat down with that game, it looked like, you know, a very, you know, cartoony, kid-friendly, you know, fun time.
Yeah.
You know, I pop it in, and suddenly I'm hearing these, like, beautiful orchestral arrangements. I think in the past you kind of described it having a pastoral sound.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, where did this come from? Like, how did the, like, what was your process for thinking up that particular breed of music?
I think because I just viewed it as being the classic English country garden. That's the way I kept thinking about it.
Mm.
And, you know, being a, you know, classically trained, you know, person, I have a great love for the music of Elgar and Vaughan Williams, who are really both classic English composers who have that really, they have that sound for me, especially Vaughan Williams has that kind of really modally, folky sort of thing about him. And I just thought this is a real chance, because it's kind of music that I love to write, you know, but don't get a chance to do it. So I just thought, you know, I'll try it out and see if the team like it. And I think it's really going to suit the game. So that's how it came around. It was my kind of homage to those two fantastic composers. I mean, I'm not for minutes and I'm as good as them at all, but mm-hmm. it was me having a go at trying to be Vaughan Williams and Elgar, really.
I think it's definitely just interesting to hear that in a video game that is primarily targeted to kids. It's just not, you know, it's not your usual stuff you're used to hearing.
I just think that, you know, people often think orchestral music is a bit highbrow, and, you know, I think that you can easily get that impression of it. And, you know, I think it was just all about, I think a good tune's a good tune, you know, whatever you use to write it, whether it's metal or, you know, whatever it could be. I think, you know, you write a good tune, you write a good tune. So I've always endeavoured to try to write a good melody. That's what I've always been, you know, whether I get there or not, you know, I try my best to do that. I may not get there, but I try my best. And, you know, I think that Pinata hopefully has got some good tunes that people could like regardless of what style they were in.
Yeah.
And I think you get, and I think like when you see Tommy Tallarico doing these video games live concert these days, it's amazing that, you know, parents are getting asked by the kids to take them to watch a symphony orchestra, which is incredible, you know. I bet parents can't believe it, you know. So they're going, what, my son wants to go and see the symphony orchestra, you know, playing video games tunes. It's incredible. So I think it proves that it's orchestra can sometimes be looked upon as being a little bit stuck up and highbrow, but in actual fact, it isn't always that way. And it's a medium that can be used for anything, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Viva Pinata really nails that, as well as Video Games Live, which I've definitely been to a number of times.
Yeah.
Both of the things are kind of bridging the gap and saying, hey, they don't have to be completely distinct, separate worlds. You can, in fact, enjoy both.
Definitely. And I think that because video games seems to be getting more and more prevalent as every day goes by these days, that I think people are accepting more of an instrumental piece of music that's played by orchestra than they used to be. It's getting to be a really, it just amazes me how many people really get into video games music these days. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's really fun to watch people, excuse me, it's really fun to watch people from both sides of the fence, you know, try something different. You have people remixing older music in more modern styles, taking modern music and giving it an 8-bit makeover, people from movies writing for games and games writing for movies, and
yeah,
it's cool to watch all that happen.
Yeah, there's a channel in the UK called Classic FM, which is the country's biggest classic music station. And every year they have this Hall of Fame, which people vote for. It's the top 300 composers that they vote for. And, you know, bizarrely enough, I got voted in at number 174 this year. I was the fourth highest new entry in the Classic FM chart
for Viva Pinata.
I was absolutely stunned.
That's fantastic.
You know, and it just shows that channels like Classic FM are realizing that there's a whole market of, you know, kids out there who are getting into classical music and getting into that kind of stuff because of games like Viva Pinata and World of Warcraft and all the rest of it, you know, because, you know, they're realizing that they're going, oh, I quite like that. And they might like something by Wagner that's very similar or something. You know, it's really amazing that stuff happens. And I just couldn't believe it. The fact that, you know, like I was number 174, but like in the top five was Jeremy Soule for Skyrim. And mm-hmm. I think, and Yamatsu was there for Final Fantasy. So, I mean, you know, it's like, there was three video games composers in the top 300. And I thought that was incredible. And the fact that it just goes to show that people are picking up on it and channels like that are going, well, you know, this is a whole new audience for us, getting people introduced to future classical music probably, you know, so it's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. So looking back, having, you know, started from the very beginning of working with Game Boy tunes and then working all the way up to having a full orchestra with, for example, Kingdoms of Amalur, do you prefer one style more than the other? Do you like working with the orchestra, or do you prefer just being on your own?
I mean, I do really like working with the orchestra. I've done that, I guess, the last five games I've done really been full orchestra scores. And it's just the way it's been. Mm-hmm. Not through choice, just because that's what the kind of music that the games are called for. So, you know, I think because I've had that classical upbringing when I was a kid, I think I do like the orchestra thing. But, you know, like I've written some stuff for mobile phone games recently, which I really, really enjoy doing, you know. And, you know, so I mean, I don't think I've got any complete preference. I think it's just nice to be able to write music, really. I mean, whatever that may be for, like yeah. I've just done Castle of Illusion, you know, the Mickey Mouse remake.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that was done using MIDI stuff. I used no orchestral samples, but it's all MIDI. You know, so I just think I'm happy that I can just get to write music, really. I don't care if it's metal or orchestral or I don't really care. I just like to do music. It's great.
Yeah, and not so much the medium, just the actual, you know, results and process.
I think you can easily, anything you write could easily be arranged for whatever medium it may happen to, you know, it doesn't matter. For me, it's all about the chords and the melody and all the rest of it. So what you do with it after that's up to you.
And, you know, before you mentioned, I guess, kind of your musical philosophy of always looking for that melody.
Yeah.
And I would like to personally say that I support that. That's one of my favorite things about... I mean, honestly, most rare games, specifically, you know, the Grant Kirkhope sound, you'll always remember those tunes. Those are the things that won't just get stuck in your mind, but will kind of resonate in your mind.
Yeah, it's very kind of you to say so. I think I really, you know, I always say I always endeavor to do that, and I may not always get there, but that's the thing that I've always think about. And I must admit, I think that you know, looking at movies these days, I don't hear an awful lot of that. I hear a lot of exciting music, but I don't remember any of it. And I think, you know, walk out the theatre, and I think I don't remember any of that music, but I just remember it's been quite exciting and whatever, but I don't get it. And I don't know whether that trend's going to continue or it's going to fade out, or I don't know. But for me, it's, you know, the music of John Williams and people like that, you really remember it, or Danny Elfman and people like that, or Alan Silvestri or Jerry Goldsmith. I mean, they just wrote good tunes that you can remember. I mean, obviously they've got music in between that that's really exciting and not memorable or not particularly designed to be that way. But when it comes to the big moment when the baddie appears or whatever it may be, you've got something to remember it by. And I think that I would say that the reason that people like, you know, Lady Gaga are number one in the top in the pop charts is because they've probably written a damn good tune, you know. So, you know, you don't hear too many ambient tracks at number one, do you? So I just think that the average person in the public who doesn't know anything about music, just knows what they like my wife or my kids, for instance, they don't care if it's hip or anything. They couldn't care less. All they want to hear is something that they like and remember, you know. So I think that it's easy to get wrapped up in that kind of thing where, oh, no, I don't want melody and all that. I just think that as a human being, most people want to hear something they can remember. And that's what I always think.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. I've always kind of been in that same camp. I mean, probably because I played video games as a kid, and it was stuff like Mario, and it was stuff like Banjo-Kazooie, and the movies I watched, stuff like Star Wars, and I really appreciated that. So, yeah, happy to see someone's carrying the torch.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think when I did Kingdoms Amalur: Reckoning, that was like a very big RPG epic thing, and I was thinking, you know, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, that was the kind of thing going through my mind at the time, and, you know, said it before, I spent an awful lot of time listening to the first three Harry Potter scores by John Williams because they're so excellent. And, you know, I just tried out my own little way to just do that thing that I was trying to learn his technique of, you know, amazing melody, but in between that really complicated music that goes to lots of ideas in a very short period of time, but it doesn't really get in the way of the action. So I wanted to try and learn that technique. And, you know, I'm not saying I learned it anywhere near as good as he can do. Of course I didn't, but that was what I was trying to do. I was trying to get that, you know, bag on the money when it comes to the melody. Mm-hmm. When it's a really exciting fighting piece, make sure it's exciting and all over the place. And, you know. So I think it's a lot of people think, oh, melody, if you got a melody, it detracts from the action and people get, I think that's complete nonsense. I think that's just rubbish. I mean, I think when, you know, there's nothing beating that bit when Darth Vader turns up and you hear da, 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 da. You know, it's just, it's fantastic, you know. So I think there's a place for all of it. But I don't like it when there's no melody. I want to hear something I can remember.
Yeah, I'm definitely in that same camp. Mm. And well, while we're talking about, you know, inspiring music and music that we enjoy listening to, I think that's a perfect segue into the final segment, known as
Hey, Listen,
where we'll give some music recommendations of stuff we've been listening to.
Oh, okay. Let's see what I've listened to recently. Well, you know, I'm still a massive Harry Potter fan, so I still listen to John Williams' scores. Not the others, just his. Mm-hmm. But I'd say from Chamber of Secrets, it's called Reunion of Friends. It's like the last track, I think.
Okay.
I just love that piece. It's where then the Great Hall and Hagrid turns up because he's been fired and Hermione's been unfrozen from being petrified and all the rest of it. I just think that piece is really brilliant. It's some really great moments in that piece of music.
Okay.
Another good score, like an awful lot, is Stardust by Ilan Eshkeri, which for that movie was out in 2007, somewhere around there. That is a fantastically good score. And I haven't, you know, it's probably one of the last scores that I bought, really. That was just so, it's a film that I think not a lot of people saw, but it's a great movie, and the music is absolutely fantastic. And he's kind of disappeared a little bit as a composer, which is a bit of a shame. I really thought he was going to be a real new force to be reckoned with. What else have I been listening to? The thing is, I listen to either heavy metal or orchestral scores. There seems to be no in between for me.
Uh-huh, so, right.
I listened to quite a lot of Queens, right, recently, because Queens like a great. And John Williams. I do quite like the Avengers score by Alan Silvestri.
Yeah.
It's got some decent parts to it. Trying to think what else I've been listening to. How about you? What have you been listening to?
I just brought one thing today, which I just discovered recently, actually.
Right.
And it's music from a game called Alter Ego Dreamwalker.
All right.
But it's by Ken Snyder, who's maybe better known as Coda.
All right.
And it's a really excellent soundtrack. I've never played the game, but it kind of takes, you know, everyone does sort of chiptune-y sounds these days.
Right, right.
But I feel like it takes it a level beyond that. Has a really good pace to it. A lot of exciting, optimistic electronic sounds. And I like listen to it twice over right away. So Alter Ego Dreamwalker, that's my recommendation for today.
Yeah, I should check that out. I mean, I've got to say, I quite like the chiptune thing. I'm kind of, I'm getting a bit sick of that kind of the hybrid orchestra mixed with synth. It just gets on my nerves. Mm-hmm. But I like the chip tunes. What I like about that is it's nice and dry, and it's like, I don't know, it reminds me of my days on the Game Boy, and I like the way it works. It's good.
Yeah, it's a bit of nostalgia without leaning too heavily on it, and I think that's what Coda does really well. So, and all this will be in the show notes, by the way, so you listeners can go check it out if you want.
Yeah.
I guess kind of to finish off here, Grant, you have any projects or pages or Twitter accounts you want to plug, anything like that?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Grant Kirkhope. I'm on Facebook, Grant Kirkhope. I've got my website, you know, grantkirkhope.com. Mm-hmm. Currently working on Desktop Dungeons with Dari Baranowski. We're doing that together.
Oh, excellent.
Just finished Mickey Mouse, the Castle of Illusion remake. So that should be out soon. I think that sounds good.
Oh, yeah, sure, for sure.
I'm working on a game for Tiny Co. up in San Francisco, which I guess I can't mention what that is yet at the moment.
Okay.
And I've got something else as well. And I'm also doing the music for Yaiba Ninja Gaiden Z at the moment as well.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, but that's going to be all electronic, so I've had to do some quite dubstepy stuff for that, which is a bit out of my comfort zone, but it sounds right at the moment.
Ah, sounds fun.
I'm doing bits and pieces all over the place. I'm just trying to do as much as I can, and I've been very fortunate. Gorfane Sforts, who are one of LA's premier agencies, have just signed me up as a composer.
Oh, congratulations!
Yeah, so I'm super excited about that. I mean, you know, I mean, it's unbelievable, really. I mean, the same, you know, agency as John Williams and Michael Giacchino and James Horner and, you know, those people. So I'm completely bottom of the list, you know, when it comes to that. But I'm very flattered to be even considered by them. So that just happened last week, so I'm over the moon about that.
Wow, that's fantastic, Grant. It's amazing to see how this all started with moving Donkey Kong, you know, chiptune sounds from one console to another, and now you've signed on with, you know, the John Williams people, essentially, so...
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, you know, I can't believe it, really. I'm a little bit in, I can't, what the word for it is, cloud nine. I just can't believe it's happened. I keep thinking they're going to call back and say, oh, sorry, it's meant somebody else, not
it's
you.
It's all been a mistake.
Yes, I mean, a different Grant Kirkhope, you know, so, I'm super excited about that, you know, because I would love to, you know, I like to do games, but I'd like to do some movies too, so I'm hoping that I can get some, you know, I may be able to manage the worst B-movie creature feature at the start, so I don't care what it is, as long as I just like to have a crack at it, really. So I'm hoping that they can do something for me there, and I'd just like to be involved. And you know, I'll do from mobile phone up to anything. I don't really care. I just want to write tunes, really.
Yeah, that's fantastic, and definitely keep us posted. And if you end up doing that B-movie horror film, let us know, and we'll do a recap interview.
All right. Yeah, some kind of, you know, Mongolian worm from outer space, something like that. That's what I'll be doing, something like that. If I'm lucky, that's probably might be a bit of a mistake at the moment. So
that sounds fantastic to me. So
yeah.
All right then. Well, I guess that pretty much concludes our interview here, Grant.
Okay.
So thank you very much for coming. It was a pleasure.
No, honestly, I'm so pleased to talk to anybody, really. So I'm very grateful you want to talk to me at all.
Yeah, for sure, and hopefully we'll have you back in the future. Actually, I'm secretly hoping to get a number of you guys on at the same time, maybe Jimmy Henson and Danny, and Danny Baranowski, and if I could get all of you guys into a room, you'd just do my job for me, and I could just sit here and enjoy.
So. Yeah, we just fight each other and insult each other for the entire time. That's what we do normally, so it's quite entertaining, really.
Perfect. A cage match, exactly what I'm looking
Absolutely.
For.
Absolutely.
Anyway, this has been Grant Kirkhope, for which we are very thankful, and I have been Stephen Kelly, and will continue to be Stephen Kelly in the future. And you've been listening to another No Tune Unturned interview. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time. Uh-huh.